Good afternoon. Welcome to Igniting Wet Blankets. A friend of mine spoke to a school, public school principal in a large school district in Texas and asked him the question that we're trying to get answered here. He said, if you walk into a classroom and the students are unmotivated, What do you suggest that the teachers do? And the principal said, well, they need to prepare. If the students aren't motivated, it's because the teacher wasn't prepared. He said, a teacher who has their illustrations ready and knows the students and is excited about what they're going to teach will motivate the students. Now, sometimes it goes a little beyond that. We will try to discuss some of those things, but the premise that we will be operating on today is that preparation produces motivation. If you want people to do something, you need to prepare to get them to do that. Now, we have an object lesson. We're talking about igniting wet blankets, right? Well, this isn't exactly a blanket, but we're going to go ahead and make it wet. Right. So, sometimes our students seem like this. It seems like nothing we do can get them to work or do what we would like for them to do. When we relate to them, to us, they seem just like a wet blanket. Right? There's not a lot of things happening with a wet blanket. But sometimes somebody needs to come along. It's not wet enough yet. Oh, yeah, it is. How'd that happen? Okay. You see, just because a blanket is wet doesn't mean it won't burn. Remember what I was talking about? What's the premise we're operating from?
Preparation.
All right, this is alcohol, actually. And by the way, that was not the one I was drinking out of. All right. I have a student who met a milestone this year. In fact, we got very excited about it when this happened and had a special day of school because for the first time in 4 years of schooling, he had completed all of his assignments on time. I have another student who consistently completed all of... Yeah, that did make a little bit of a matter, didn't it? Consistently completed all her assignments on time, but they were incomplete. She just flew through her work and handed it in. She was done. And another student who rarely completed work on time, but always got 100% because he was so meticulous. Right? Those are three types of students who need motivation to become a balanced person. So we're going to try to figure out how to provoke people to become a better person. It takes work. The student who finally began completing his work, one afternoon, he was unfinished, and another student's work was unfinished, and I said, it's time for art class, and everyone else is going to start, and as soon as you all are done, you can have art too. And he had, if I remember right, about 20 problems to work on, and the other student maybe about 5. And he finished first. This is the guy who can't get his work done, right? And next morning, after devotions, I took him out into the kitchen and said, you know, yesterday, when you had that oomph to get there, you got your work done. You can do it. I know you can. And that was the aha moment for him. It didn't suddenly cure him. He is not a totally different person, but he is a better person than he had been. The girl who was consistently handing in unfinished work or work that she hadn't worked, she had not applied herself to, got to the place that she was basically failing. And I just let her know that unless you do something different, you'll be studying with someone else next year. And that was her aha moment. And suddenly, we put a little more oomph into this stuff and everything. The boy who was so meticulous that he couldn't finish on time because then it might not be perfect. I looked in the teacher's guides and I read the suggested amounts of time that work was supposed to get done, and I gave him a timer. And I said, this is what the teacher's guide says you should accomplish this lesson in. It's a math lesson. It says 45 minutes. When the timer goes off, whatever you've got done is what I'll check, and everything else is wrong. It changed that young man. He later became a teacher, and he's a very, I would say, well-rounded person today. And so on. To provoke them, we have to be responsible. You have to take it upon yourself to motivate. Once again, our takeaway for today is
preparation
produces motivation. Take that challenge. If they're not working, it's your fault. Yeah, sorry. That's mean, isn't it? And to round that out, Jesus had one student who was not motivated, right? Judas. But you shouldn't go home then and say, aha, I have a schoolroom full of Judases, so I don't have to work, right? All right. No. Be responsible. Make it your problem. Be single-minded. When I started teaching after I was married, we were short on cash. The church was short on cash. And so I was teaching and going to work after school. In fact, working 8 to 10 hours after school. Getting 3 to 4 hours of sleep a night. And that was not sustainable. So I quit my job. And the school board was very grateful. It wasn't but a week later, one of the moms said, the children like school now. Because when I was trying to be a double-minded man, that they were not motivated to enjoy school. And when I was focused, when I could stick to it, that was motivational to them. Be decisive. Sometimes making a wrong choice is better than making no choice at all. Trying something is better than waiting for the perfect solution. Sometimes we're trying to think of that. We want the ideal thing. We think there's a silver bullet we're going to find to fix this person, when if we just start randomly trying things, we find the silver bullet. I got a letter from one of my teachers this year. And she said, I don't remember. She didn't recall something I had written about. She said what she remembers is she couldn't get me to get my work done. But what she doesn't recall is that she was trying. And what actually happened is I took every single subject home from school one day. And as I was carrying those from the school bus into the house, I had an aha moment. I said, you know what? I could have done all this stuff at school and I wouldn't have homework. It took me about 3 years to get to that point where I actually could complete, because I had developed so many bad habits. And the fact of the matter was, it really wasn't anything my teacher did, other than just continuing to assign work to me as though I was a normal person. And so sometimes we're better off just keeping on. However, on the other side of that, attempting solutions exhibits resourcefulness, and sometimes it's encouraging to your student if they know that you're trying to help them conquer their problem. I'm not telling you not to do something. Be disciplined. You know, teachers don't have the privilege of showing up grouchy. Right? We're supposed to have a good day every day. The students expect that. If you don't, then how can you expect them to show up and be motivated on a daily basis? Right? They're not going to achieve a standard higher than their teacher is. So, discipline yourself to have a good day on a daily basis. Be reliable, on time with devotions, recess. You want to know something that is the opposite of motivation for your students? Just go 15 minutes over time when it's recess, right? Bam, their motivation is gone for the day. Be on time. Be orderly. A disorderly classroom is not very motivating. If a student is struggling to get a lesson done, but they can't find a dictionary because it's buried, whose problem was that? And so on. Respond consistently when they are suffering from a lack of motivation. Don't crack down on them and keep them in from every recess one day and then do nothing the next. Right? Be consistent. The Bible talks about being line upon line. And along with this, one of the problems I believe that teachers face in dealing with unmotivated students is ignoring the average ones. There is something to letting the unmotivated student know that they're not the most important person in the room. It is not appropriate for a teacher to spend half of their time with one or two students. That's not okay. Most of you have enough other students that you should be evening your time out as much as possible. I'm not saying that you don't try to help these people, but don't make it your sole occupation. Be perceptive. The Bible talks about considering one another to provoke and to love and to good works. This is probably the thing that keeps me awake at night more than anything else. As a student who is not working, I lay awake trying to figure out, how do I get this person to work? Study their personalities. That's what Ivan was talking about this morning. And work to change the person rather than the symptom. And with this, thinking about their personality. If you have a highly energetic student, that might be what's causing their restlessness. I have had students who couldn't get their work done because they needed to run around the schoolroom. I mean, the schoolhouse, sorry. And so I would let them run around the schoolhouse and they come back and get back to work. Recognize those types of things. Other students, Brother Ivan talked about being easily distracted. I am a kindred spirit in that respect. If you have students who are easily distracted, don't put them toward the front of the room where you're having classes in front of them on a regular basis. Put them somewhere where they can easily block those things out, and so on. Study their home life. You know, Jesus used examples that were typically right in front of him and his students, that were familiar to them. It's one of the issues with a curriculum that is standardized. There's no way you can standardize a curriculum for every student that's ever born, right? You're going to have to make it standard for your students. And with that, involve their parents. On the way here, I stopped at the bank to put some checks in the bank there. This elderly lady was behind me, and we got to talking. She said, I taught first grade for 30 years. I said, well, I've got a question for you. I said, what did you do with unmotivated students? Oh, that was not a problem. I have supportive parents. Right? So, I fear sometimes we as teachers try to deal with issues that we should not be working on alone. In my experience, I have yet to see an unmotivated student who could resist pressure from both the school and the home at the same time. They don't. They cave. They're like, okay, I give up! And usually they get over their problem. Consider the mechanics of motivation. Everyone has a button that gets them going. For some people, if I say, would you like to go riding? And Bradley's up and running, right? A couple other people look like they would be happy about that too. Others, it's like, oh, would you like to stamp? Right? Okay. Bam! Their head's up, ready to go. Or shopping, right? Things like that. Would you like to go to the thrift store this afternoon? There you go. Right? You have to know what turns, what gets people's attention, and this comes into studying that. But everyone has a button. Understand the fact that we begin with external motivation, right? As little children, we motivate them, you know, from the hindquarters up. And we hope it gets up to the brain and then eventually into the heart. That's the way things happen. But it's from the outside in. What we want them to overcome external motivation, right? That's a very important concept for not only teachers to understand, but their students as well. I tell my students that this is a fact of life. People start with motivation from the outside, but mature people are motivated on the inside. So that's a goal we're working for. Then they understand the process, why we're trying to get there. Understand the fact that motivation, and particularly reward systems, need to have positive and negative consequences, right? A battery has no power unless it has a positive and a negative cable. So, you know, if the children get a piece of candy every time they get their work done right, but nothing bad happens when they do it wrong, that's not realistic. And on the other side of it, if they get spanked every time they don't get their work done right, but there's no reward for getting done on time, that's not real life either. Understand the levels of motivation. In his book, Teach Like Your Hair's on Fire, Raphael Esquith has a list of six things, and I have applied some biblical heroes, or not, to some of these things. Think about the first one is, I don't want to get in trouble, right? That's our, like, that's the first motivation we have. Consider Ahab. When Ahab found out that he was in trouble for killing Naboth, he was very upset, and he actually repented, but the only reason was he didn't want to be in trouble. That was it. That was his only motivation. The next level of motivation that children typically get to is, I want a reward. I'll do something if you give me something, right? This is like Balaam. Do you look up to Balaam? Are your children going to look up to Balaam? Let them know that, you know, that's as high as you're at right now. You know, if the only way you will get your work done is for a piece of candy or a quarter or whatever it is, you're at a pretty low level of motivation. I want to please someone. Many children get to this place about by the time they get to school, and they're there, and they pretty well worship those first and second grade teachers, but their only motivation is really just to please that person. And that's at about the level that Aaron was, right? When the people came to him and said, make us an idol. Well, he did. When Moses came down and said, hey, these people are being bad, Aaron said, yeah, they are. Right? He was just trying to please whoever was there. And that's not a very good level of motivation. Children then often get to the point where they follow the rules. Right? I whatever the rules are, I do the rules. I follow the rules. The Pharisees did that. Are we satisfied with that level of motivation? No, it's not good enough. Then they go on beyond, because, for example, on the playground, if someone falls and scrapes their knee, is there a rule that says, stop the game and help that person out? Nobody's going to have a rule like that. So then the next level is, I'm considerate of others. And that's about like Judah was. When they took Benjamin down to Egypt, and Joseph was going to keep Benjamin there, Judah said, no, that's going to hurt my dad's feelings. So I'll stay instead of him. I was considerate. But do we view Judah's overall motivation as being, was that somewhere we really want to stop? Not really. The best level of motivation is, I have a personal code of conduct that I follow. Think about Joseph and Ruth. There was no one there to make them do the right thing. They did it because it was the right thing, because they did the right thing. And they had that was internal motivation. Think about that. If you look at that list of things, it goes from the outside in, external to internal motivation. And if our students understand that that's what we're aiming for, it helps a lot. Consider your students' capabilities. We all, I hope, each of us has a brain. But we didn't all get the same model. Right? If you look in the parking lot, not all the Hickles are the same either. And so we have to try to compensate by using my model of a brain to communicate to your model of a brain. And typically we do that through the five senses. And we must recognize that students have five senses, not just two. Often we rely on seeing and hearing solely. All right. When we did this little experiment here, you also experienced some smelling. And some of you will probably remember this topic more for the smell. Or you may even be reminded of this topic by the odor that you will associate with it. All right. I like to use food to teach because it includes another sense, their sense of taste. Krista, what do fractions taste like? Fractions taste like bananas. Okay. From then on, when the students are eating bananas, they're thinking about fractions, and it has this nice connotation, right? Because who doesn't like bananas? Don't raise your hand if you don't. All right. And then the sense of feeling, when counting change, doing things where we can actually touch things, measuring things, get the real thing. Give them change. Give them a tape measure and actually physically do things. Very few students will be unmotivated if they get to act as part of their lesson. They get to do it. There are four basic kinds of learners. And we're going to use a man assembling a barbecue to get this across. The first kind gets the instructions and reads the instructions thoroughly and gets the barbecue put together perfectly the first time because he read the instructions, right? Enjoys reading. The next one grabs the instruction manual, looks at all the pictures, and he puts the barbecue together following the pictures. And if the pictures are accurate enough, he gets the barbecue together the first time. But he didn't read any of the words because he likes pictures. He's visual. There are those who will grab the instructions and they're like, okay, it says first, attach leg A to leg C and tighten with bolt Z. And they're reading everything out loud. Why? Because they like to hear. There are people whose primary source of learning is through their ears. You will find these students whispering to themselves while they're working. Let them whisper. Right? It is not wrong to do that. That's just because that's the way God wired their brain. If they're not being disruptive, it is fine. And it can keep them motivated. And then there are those who just simply start grabbing things and putting them together, and instruction books are for losers. Right? They have to do something. They have to have their hands on. Those are the ones who, when you say, let's measure the classroom, and they're running for that tape measure, they want to make sure they get their hands on that thing. They have to experience things. They have to touch it. They have to feel it. Recognize that those are the four basic types of learners. And once again, I say basic because, as Ivan said, people are complicated, so don't just put everybody in a box here. But that some of your students may prefer some of those methods over the ones that you're using, and you may have to shift gears. People also are typically primary either left or right-brained. If you're left-brained, you enjoy logic and words, reading, talking. If you're right-brained, you typically are a little more intuitive. You may know the answer, but not know how you got it. And you love pictures and so on. Things like that. Understand that for someone to learn, they must actually memorize something, right? And that no one is actually truly incapable of learning a new thing. There may be some exceptions to that statement, but very few. Our brains are made up of about 100 billion neurons, each of which is capable of having 10,000 connections. Anyone want to do the math on that and figure out how many connections that actually is? Your short-term memory is what you're using right now to process the things I'm saying and so on. However, to actually remember, it has to get into your long-term memory. Our minds have two different memory sections, which is why your students can get everything right in class time and maybe even for 45 minutes after that and totally forget the next day. That just means that they got the information into their short-term memory but not the long-term. So then how do we get things into their long-term? There are three different ways to get something into your long-term memory. There's sensory, which is something you've touched, something you've felt. This may also include something very emotional, an experience. For example, has anyone in here ever been in an accident? Yes. All right. Can you remember how that felt? But not just the things happening. Do you remember your feeling, your emotions that went along with that, your fear? And that's those are some of the memories. We're not going to get a lot of that in the classroom, all right? But it is one of the ways that things go into the long-term memory. And this is where singing can actually overcome that, because singing is emotional, right? And so it can take advantage of that. Visuospatial, where you picture things. So, for example, if you say in the living room, the couch is Africa, right? And the easy chair is Antarctica. So which of these two is bigger? Right? And students can get the idea. They're picturing something and there's a connection to something familiar to them. That is one way to get things in. And then language. Language just simply takes words and assigns them to a thing. So for example, if I say the word bench, you know what I'm talking about. But can you see a bench? Can you feel a bench in this room? No, not necessarily. I don't think there's one. But that's language. Some people can learn by language, but we need to understand that not everybody does. And some of them may need that picture. Some of them may need feel their emotions a little bit. Limitations. Limitations are realities. People are limited in their ability to get things one way or the other. They are not excuses. Okay? That is probably the most important thing for me to get across to you about the motivation. Just because someone is limited in their ability to add and subtract does not mean that they should never learn how to do it. That just might mean that it's harder for them. That's okay. Students' attention spans. The younger the student, the shorter the attention span. One of the things with motivating these students is what I call catch and release teaching, where you touch the student and walk away. You give them the next thing to do and you leave. It's okay. Give them just a little bite at a time. Play games with them to get them motivated. This is something I enjoy doing with my students. We can do that with you all. Let's see, we'll start with the second row. Just start counting, and when I say stop, the next person needs to count. All right. You may say five numbers, you may say one number. All right. So everyone has to stay with us, because I might get over here to Katie before we get to 10. You never know. All right. So just start counting at one.
One, two,
stop.
Four, five, six, seven, eight.
Stop.
10, 11, 12,
stop. 15, 16,
16.
Stop.
20, 20, 20, 20, 20.
Okay. And then just a minute here. And then just to make it more fun, instead of going across a row, I'm going to point at someone. Right? So now we've got everyone is involved. You snooze, you lose, right? So go ahead. Where were you?
24.
Katie, go ahead and start. Stop.
7.8.9.
Stop.
30.1, 32,
33. Stop. Good, good, good. All right. Those are simple things. You can drill counting backwards. You can count by fractions. You can do whatever. That's a fun little game to play. There are many others that I don't have time to tell you about. Do be aware in limitations that the stress level that your students are facing does affect the motivation. If they have been ill or are ill and sniffling and so on, it's okay to not give them as much work. Right? If there's been a death in the family, have a little patience with them. Be visionary. Look at the long term. Too often we want to get them to get their work done right now without dealing with an underlying issue in their personality. An example of this, if I may use this, would you come up here? And put your nose about right there. Can you see there? Is that, how big is that now?
Am I supposed to look at it?
Yeah, look at it. How big is the dot?
Like in inches? About an inch?
No, just is it big or little?
Big.
Big, okay. Now I want you to walk all the way to the back of the room. Okay, do you get what's going on here? When she's right up there, that, you know, this problem that I'm facing looks really big because it's right here. It's in front of me. Now, long-term vision, you're back there. Now, is that dot big or little? Small. We've got a bigger problem going on here. You may sit down. Thank you for being willing to be a guinea pig. I appreciate it. Develop positive expectations. Jesus told his people, I'll make you fishers of men. You will be witnesses. Think about this student's potential. If you have a very artistic student, praise them for that, even if they can't spell. Okay? Not that you don't want to teach them spelling too, but let them know that you see something good. And everyone does have something good in them. And then communicate realistic expectations for each of your students. Deal with misconceptions that they might have. For example, a student might say, I can't do this. Say, well, you need to get tougher. You need some tenacity to work through that thing. Some students learn to be helpless because the teacher is giving them too much help. Rather than leading a student all the way to an answer in a problem, just give them the next step. Praise them for what they've done up to now. Oh, good. You got step one and step two right. Here's the next thing. See you later. Okay. Don't overhelp students. And then we have those perfectionists. I fear failure. I might not get 100%. So what? I don't either. Right? The difference between a perfectionist and a craftsman, they both see the imperfections in their work, but one of them keeps working. All right. Let your students know that. It's okay. All right. You are up. Questions, comments on basically preparing to provoke students? Or anything you would like to add? Yes, Bradley.
This thing about the positive expectations versus the realistic expectations. It is true that students generally perform the way we expect.
Yes.
On the other hand, where how do you know when you're pushing way up to that line? This student can't spell.
Mm-hmm.
For example. Eventually, they're on that point, like, okay, let's just leave it. How do you know when you're getting to that point? We want them to keep trying.
Yes.
We want them to keep going.
Okay.
How do you know when you're pushing
Bradley's
them
question.
To the breaking point?
How do you know when you are pushing them to the breaking point? I'm not planning on answering all the questions here, okay? Just in case you were wondering. All right, for sake of time, I'll give it a thought. And if somebody else has something else to add, you can. I would say when the student starts to lose control of their emotions, and I'll be honest, I'm trying to get better at this, but I do push my students to that point very, very often. If they're getting close to crying, I usually back off. But I don't apologize for pushing them to that point. I think it's okay. Is that off track? Unbalanced? Are you okay with that? Are there other signs?
Are you talking like a short-term pushing, like today or over a month?
I am, you know, I would say like, over, yeah, short-term.
Because the parents know their children better than you do.
They do. And there would be times, so long term, once again, yes, get the parents involved. The parents may say, hey, I've had parents say this, look at their children's work. They can do better than that. Okay, then, you help me get them there. Thank you for bringing that up. Let's go on to the next part. Prepare to prioritize. A clear vision has clear priorities. So we're talking about that long distance thing. We see a big problem rather than just this little thing we're working with. It's right in front of us and it looks horrible. They're not getting their work done today. All right. Very seldom is that the real issue. It's usually something bigger. So we have to get a clear vision of what's the most important thing to deal with then. Prioritize minimums. Children want and need to know what is the least amount that they can learn to get by. That sounds horrible, doesn't it? But it's true, and it works. It's fine. I love being able to tell my students, if you get this one thing out of this lesson, you're good. That's all you have to know. That's all you need. In his book, The Seven Laws of the Learner, Bruce Wilkerson calls this the irreducible minimum. What is the smallest nugget of truth you can get that you can walk away with, you can take home with you, and that's what you need? So, for example, our takeaway for today is
preparations produces motivation.
Okay, how many words is that? Do you all think you can handle three words? Think so? Can you repeat that again all together?
Preparation produces motivation.
Thank you. Very good. I'll warn you that it's not easy to find the minimum. But when you do, it's like digging for gold and finding a nugget. It's hard work until you get there. But once you've got it, it's gold. You're golden. You can tell that student, this is the nugget you need. Noun's name. If you can remember that, you're good to go. Itty bitty little thing. Communicate that minimum to your students. Give your students, if you've got a goal for the big picture, give that to your students. Give them clear direction of, for example, if they're at the level of motivation that I want to please you, and you realize that if you're not in the room, they're not behaving anymore. Because the only reason they behave is because you're there, right? Go ahead and tell them, that's not okay. The big picture is that we want you to be good because it's the right thing to do. Even little children can get that. And they might know, I'm not there yet. That's okay. I know I haven't achieved perfection. Paul didn't even achieve perfection, but he was working for it. And if we know where we are and where we're trying to get, it can give them some purpose. If the student knows that I'm not working fast enough at school yet, but you tell them that if you would get five more problems done every hour, you'd get done today. Something that they can get a hold of. Teach your students to master the minimum themselves. And this is going to take them beyond maybe doing half of a lesson in a day to go ahead and getting the whole thing done. How are they going to do that? They're going to need to learn methods of studying. For example, some people call this teaching analytical thinking. One of the things I teach the first day of every school term is the three-pass method of getting a lesson done. Is anyone else familiar with this method? Bradley is. Would you be willing to verbalize it?
Go ahead.
I'll get it. On the first pass of going through any lesson, it doesn't matter, math, reading, English, you do everything you can do that you can do without a lot of effort. And if you come to a question you don't have the answer for, you put a star beside it. Once you have done all the problems you can do on your own, you go back and look at those ones that you couldn't do the first time, and often you can do at least some of them. And once you've done everything you can in that lesson, then you ask the teacher for help. There's so much work ethic that they learn by using that method, and students will know that method and not use it. And sometimes the teacher has to help them. They'll raise their hand or whatever, and you'll come over to their desk and they're on question two, and there's nothing else done. You're not using the three-pass method. See you later. Right. We have to discipline them some to do the right thing. You don't have to use that method, but use a method. Teach them a method of studying that can keep them working. Teach them to work at a lesson until they get it themselves. The other day, I told a short story. Did you hear about the button in the salad? It was part of the dressing. The funnest part of telling that is watching how many people don't get it the first time. All right. And my point there is that students can learn that it is actually fun to learn. There's learning can be its own reward. That, aha, we all enjoy that. I enjoy learning something new, and so on. Mastery is its own reward. I don't know how many of you, anybody here have a hobby? Yes, what's your hobby?
Bow fishing.
Bow fishing. Right. As you get better at it,
What happens with your enthusiasm for that hobby?
Want to do it some more.
You want to do it some more. That is called skill-based enthusiasm. And this is something we need to get across to our students, that the better you get at something, the more excited you get. Right? I'll just be honest with you. This is the way I feel about teaching. The better I get at teaching, the more I get more excited about teaching. I'm thrilled with it. Prioritize the purpose. Many students think that there's no reason for this. Why would I learn it? Teachers, it is our job to have an answer for why we teach algebra. Okay? Not just because it's in the book. I tell my students it helps you learn critical thinking, even if you never use it after school. I don't care. You will think differently just because you learned algebra or diagramming, other things. I can give you reasons. The book, Handbook for Creative Teaching, again, has a list of objectives that are basically for each of the subjects in each of the each of the grades, if I say this right. But I'll use some of those. Students say, why do we have to study this? That's why, right? Don't just say it's because it's in the book or the school board said. We need better answers than that. Give them the purpose. And even beyond that, I mean, beyond just short term, give them the long term if you can. Later in life, this might be why you need it. For example, you may need to be able to diagram to understand a Bible verse. Seriously. I have diagrammed Bible verses and realized that I had been misunderstanding it because I was reading a dependent clause as the main thought rather than the main one. I'll tell them that. Give them a long term, something later in life. Why do you need to study algebra? Well, if no one studied algebra, we would have no bridges in this country longer than a piece of something that could carry you across one spot. You like bridges? I do. I like pretty bridges to boot. And the only way you're going to get one of those is if it's studying algebra. And who knows? But you might need to build a bridge later on. Right? Prioritize your illustrations to magnify the application. Jesus taught the seed is the word of God. What better illustrations could Jesus have had? Once again, preparation produces motivation. The right illustration can motivate your students. If Jesus had said the corn cob is the word of God, it just doesn't fit, right? And you're going to run out of places to go with that. But the seed was the perfect illustration. Jesus was prepared. How do students learn most things? If they're not sure what something is, what do they ask you?
What is it like?
Teachers need to have and use similes, metaphors, personifications to teach children what things are like. What is a wallaby? It is like a kangaroo. All right? And now we have a picture, except it's smaller and whatever, you know. Use nature. Jesus did. He talked about flowers, pigs, all sorts of things. Use stories. The Bible says Jesus didn't teach without using parables. You're up again just briefly here. Any thoughts on prioritizing as it relates to motivating people? If not, we're going to go on to the last part here. Prepare to practice. This especially appeals to those students who like to touch things, do things. Real practice prepares real people for real jobs. Visualize what this student might be capable of doing later in life and have them practice doing that. I have students who are efficient and quite inspirational writers. I encourage that. It's great. Do that. Practice the application. If you're telling your students that we are learning measures so that you'll be able to bake, you can do like my co-teacher did last year and bake cookies. Right? And they have to measure things and get it right. You know, the 2 cups did not apply to the salt. And so on. Practice problem solving. teach your students how to visualize things for themselves. And along with this, one of the things that I have discovered, I suppose, is that students expect two things every day. They show up for school, they expect you to get to challenge them, but they also expect to be able to succeed at that challenge. So, for example, you have a first grader who shows up for school and he learns 1 plus 1 the first day. And the next day he shows up for school and you say, we're going to learn 1 plus 1 again. Bam! Motivation's out the door. Right? He's got that one. He wants something new. But it would also go out the door if you said, okay, today we're going to do algebra. Right? It's too far. He doesn't expect to be able to succeed at that. And something amazing to me is that many of my students have lacked motivation because I was not challenging them enough. For example, when we have spelling tests, my students beg me to give them harder words at the end. And so I will. You know, can you spell camouflage? And so on. When they don't know what these words are going to be, and suddenly spelling tests have become fun. Why? Because they actually got harder. But it's fun to try something harder. Who doesn't want to learn how to drive when they're 12, right? They want to do the harder thing. And that's motivating to get the big thing. Sometimes the reason people aren't motivated is because we are not challenging, we're not recognizing their ability. We're not stretching their mind enough. Practice internal motivation. One of the things that I do to try to do this at school is delegating, right? So I might say, Chantel, would you take care of tidying the classroom after we're done here or whatever? Suddenly, she gets some motivation because this is a responsibility. And most students actually thrive with responsibility. Be realistic, once again. I wouldn't tell Chantel to move all the desks by herself, for example. Although she probably could if she really wanted to, but we need to be realistic in our requests. In conclusion, a chronically unmotivated student is a result of an unprepared teacher. To motivate these challenging individuals, we have to prepare. We must prepare to provoke, prioritize, and practice. We must set our sights on long-term benefits. Direct our students to become self-motivated workers who recognize their own shortcomings and then overcome them. For we have no greater joy than to see that our children are
walking,
not standing, not sitting, not stalling, but walking in truth. Thank you for your attention, Mr. Smith.